Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Shabbat Shalom, TGIF, happy Friday, Juma Mubarak. It's the weekend, and therefore it must be Brunch with Bernie. By the way, before, just a quick heads up, the very top of commondreams.org, you can find an article that I wrote yesterday about the article about the topic of our conversation for most of this week. It's called How Wall Street Can Bail Itself Out Without Destroying the Dollar. And commondreams.org, it's at the very top. Anyhow, Brunch with Bernie, our first hour, of course, Senator Sanders. Before that, it was Congressman Sanders. Bernie, you've been doing this with us for, what, 4 or 5 years now? And,
yep.
And thank God you're doing it. All over America, people so look forward to our weekly town hall meeting and hearing your thoughts on what's going on, your sometimes extraordinarily candid insights into how the sausage is made there in the sausage factory on Capitol Hill. And taking our calls. You've got a plan for this bailout. People need to sign up for it right now. They can get over to sanders.senate.gov to express their opinions.
And well, Tom, we do. And yeah. It's a pretty simple plan. And I will tell you that we just presented it about 3 or 4 days ago. At last count, we have 37,000 people who have signed up on a letter to Secretary of the Treasury Paulson, which basically says, in so many words, Mr. Paulson, you and your friends on Wall Street have created this problem. Don't ask the middle class to bail you out. That if a bailout is necessary, it should be the wealthiest people in this country, the people who have made out like bandits since Bush has been president who pay for this bailout, not working families who have seen a significant decline in their standard of living because of Bush's reckless policies. So you have the absurdity here that Bush's deregulation, Bush's tax breaks for the rich, Bush's unfettered free trade, which have hurt the middle class so much and lowered our standard of living. And now, while the rich have never had it so good, and their excesses and their greed have brought the financial system to the brink, what the very rich and powerful have brought the system to the brink are saying, oh, okay, we made billions. We caused the problem. Oh, by the way, you were making $30,000 or $40,000 a year. We want you to bail us out. So that's the basic premise of what that letter is about. We have now some 37,000 signatures on it. We will present it to Secretary Paulson. And if people want to add their names to it, they can do it through my website, sanders.senate.gov. Tom, what we are also talking about here, in my own view, in terms of how it should be paid if a bailout is necessary, is that there should be a 5-year 10% surtax on incomes of over $1 million a year for couples and $500,000 for single taxpayers. And the reason that we have come up with that, which would exclude 99.7% of the people from paying anything for this bailout, is that in the last 8 years, what we have seen is an incredible growing gap between the very, very rich and everybody else. And just one figure that I want to throw out, and I want people to hear this, is that since Bush has been president, the top 400 individuals, Tom, 400 people, that ain't a lot of people, 400 people have seen an increase in their wealth of $670 billion since Bush has been president.
Which is, by coincidence, is just about the amount of the bailout.
Well, isn't that something? But obviously, a lot of other people, you know, above and beyond the top 400 have also done extraordinarily well. But that's the magnitude of wealth that we are talking about here. We're talking about a massive redistribution of wealth in America from the middle class to the very rich, and then the very rich, as ex- exemplified, by the way, by Secretary Paulson himself, who was the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, a fellow who I think in 2005, received a $38 million bonus from Goldman Sachs himself. And then he is going, he says, oh, by the way, give me, who is in the middle of this whole process by which we took the system to the brink, me, who received a $38 million bonus, why don't you give me $700 billion and I'll take care of the problem. Trust me. Well, obviously, very few people here trust them, and that plan is down the toilet bowl. But to my mind, if any bailout is necessary, we have the basic principle has got to be that the people on top are going to pay for it. Furthermore, what we need to do is we have to understand how we got into this problem, and that has a great deal to do with this radical deregulation that we saw in 1999, led by Phil Graham, which essentially says government is terrible, awful. What we have got to do is allow the captains of industry, whether it is in the financial services market, whether it is in oil futures trading, they are so smart, and they will do the right thing for us all, and they will lead to prosperity for all Americans. Just let them alone. We don't need government regulating them. Let them operate under the radar screen. Let them operate in the dark. Nobody has to know what's going on. Well, that's what we have done, and that's why we are where we are today. The last point that I would make, Tom, is, and it's not getting very much attention, is this whole concept of too big to fail. And the reason you talk about a bailout, you know, what I'm hearing, and I have to tell you that in my own small state of Vermont, our phones are banging off the wall, both in Burlington and here in Washington. And what people are saying is, you know, I don't have any health insurance. Nobody is bailing me out. My job went to China. Nobody is bailing me out. I'm a small businessman. I can't make it. Nobody is bailing me out. I guess we're not too big to fail. We're just a family of four that are going to go over the cliff. My kids are suffering. We can't afford to send them to college. Does anyone care about me? Ah, but I didn't get a $38 million bonus, so I'm just not too big to fail. I guess I can fail. And all over America, you got people who are failing, workers who are failing, low-income people. We just hopefully will pass, by the way, provision that I put into introduced a while back so that people don't freeze to death this winter, you know. But bottom line, if you are a working person, you can fail. You can suffer. Your kids don't go to college. But if you're a titan of industry, hey, we got to protect you. And I think people are saying that. But the issue of too big to fail is I want people to appreciate that in the midst of all of this stuff, just for example, you have the Bank of America, which is the nation's largest depository institution, has absorbed Countrywide, the failed mortgage lender, which happened to be the largest in the country, and Merrill Lynch, that's the nation's largest brokerage house. That's all now the Bank of America. You tell me, Tom, if in 5 years now the Bank of America starts teetering, you think we're going to let that one go down?
No. And we're seeing the big fish eat the big fish even now. And the Bank of America, isn't it 9% Saudi-owned, as I recall?
I don't know that for a fact. Yeah. But that's right. And so we've got to take a hard look at these giant institutions. You and I have talked about that in the past. And we have to say, sorry, among others, Bank of America, you know what? If you're too big to fail, you're too big to exist. What that means is we have to start breaking up these institutions right now. So when they run into trouble, when they make mistakes, they can fail. People who own them will lose money without taking down the entire economy.
Bernie, I think that the Democrats, speaking strategy for a second, I had just two quick questions. Number one, in 2002, October of 2002, George Bush gave a speech in which he said that he was encouraging Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to start lending more money to specifically minorities is what he addressed. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that more than 60% of all the subprime loans were actually given to people who qualified for prime loans. The reason why was because the lenders were giving up to $4,000 bonuses to the people writing the loans to subprime loans.
Sure.
But here's Bush talking about loosening the rules.
One of the programs is designed to help deserving families who have bad credit histories to qualify for home ownership loans. You don't have to have a lousy home for first-time home buyers. You put your mind to it, the first-time home buyer, the low-income home buyer, can have just as nice a house as anybody else.
Well, that was October 2002, and everybody seems to have amnesia about the fact that this actually had a logo. It was called the Ownership Society.
Absolutely. Tom, don't you remember? Obviously, he hasn't been using this statement very long, but for his first term, he was talking about one of his great achievements is that we now have the highest level of home ownership
right
on record. That was one of his talking points.
Yeah, through these phony mortgages.
That's right. We don't talk about it too much anymore because all of those people have since foreclosed.
Right.
Been foreclosed on. So, no, you're absolutely right.
And I really think that, you know, the Democrats should take that clip and they should just shove it down his throat. And instead, the what's happening is the other way around. But
Tom, send me that clip.
I'd be pleased to. I certainly
okay.
will.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. It's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Are taking your calls, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. The board is full, as always, by this time. You can also drop by our live chat room over at TomHartman.com and see our live free web stream at AirAmerica.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Speaking the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour, our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And, Bernie, let's take some phone calls, eh? Unless there's any fine punctuation points you want to put in anything?
Nope.
Okay, great. All righty. Larry in Fountain Valley, California. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm a Goldwater Republican. I understand responsibility. What I don't understand is the board of directors who make these ridiculous compensation packages with golden parachutes, why they are not forced to accept their fiduciary responsibility and be responsible for paying any of these outlays.
Well, Larry, that's exactly what we are talking about. What we are saying is what I am saying, is given the fact that these are the people who made huge amounts of money. Let me just tell you how much money they have made. You know, the papers have been reporting that this guy made $20 million on a bonus, and Henry Paulson, who was then the CEO of Goldman Sachs, received $38 million. But I want to tell you that in 2007, when you add all of these things up together and you look at Wall Street's five biggest firms, some of which, of course, are no longer in existence, the five biggest firms, Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley, collectively, they paid $39 billion in bonuses within those five financial institutions. $39 billion in 1 year. Now that is real money. And what Larry is saying is very simple. These are the guys who made out like bandits. These are the guys who caused the problem. Why in God's name is the middle class being asked to bail out a system which they have brought to the brink? And he's right.
Yeah, he absolutely is. Harold in Vermont, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Your senator.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Bernie, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I have the pleasure of being one of your constituents here in Vermont, and it's very refreshing to hear somebody with such straightforward views and ideas on how to fix things. My question is to you today is regarding the presidential debate that's scheduled tonight between Obama and McCain. Wanted to know what your thoughts were on the posturing or politicizing of this whole debate in regards to the bailout, and what your thoughts are in regards to why what's behind this from Senator McCain.
Let me just add to that. Well said, Harold. Bernie, it seemed to me like John McCain was saying,
"There's no need to fear. Underdog is here."
Remember Underdog? He'd fly to the rescue, right? He kind of looks like Underdog.
Harold, you know, I do politics. That's what I do, and I know a little bit about it. And it just seems to me so obvious that this is political posturing. McCain's campaign is in trouble. The polls increasingly indicate that Obama is winning more and more support from the American people. And what McCain does is he really acts very impetuously. He tosses out the dice, and I guess somebody said, okay, listen, we got a good idea. The polls are going in the wrong direction. Let's come up with something dramatic. And what's dramatic is that we, and you have told the American people, you don't know much about economics. You haven't been here on the floor of the House virtually at all. I've been in the Senate now for almost 2 years, and frankly, I haven't seen McCain very much because he's been out campaigning. Fair enough. But now, because the polls are moving the other way, you, John McCain, you're going to save the day, and you're going to suspend your campaign, and you don't even have time to engage in a debate at this crucial moment of American history where the American people want to hear the differences between you and Obama. You don't just have time to do it. You're going to come down here and save the day. I mean, I think that is so patently political, so patently grandstanding, that I think the American people see through that. I'm glad, apparently, at least last that I heard, there will be a debate tonight. I hope people listen to it. And I think if you simply look at McCain's record and what he is saying, it is 4 more years of the disastrous policies that we've had for the last 8 years. And I think Obama doesn't go as far as I would like him to go. Let me be honest about that. But there is no question that he will begin the process of moving this country in a different direction. And, Tom, if we can develop that strong grassroots movement that gives him the strength to stand up to these incredibly powerful special interests here in Washington, who knows, but we may have a new Roosevelt-type era in which we re-energize the American people, we take on the big money interest, and we start making some progress for the middle class of this country.
Well, I think this is that exactly is what the Republicans are most afraid of, that and the possibility that they may be held to account for the actual crimes that they committed. I think that that's why they're in Colorado, you've got, these election officials making statements that, very, very loud and public statements that college students can't vote, which is not true. And they had to apologize later, but the news was out and the damage was done, right? I mean, they're going to do every dirty trick in the book.
They are going to do everything they can to suppress the vote. No question about that within minority communities as well. And let me just make this point before we get to the next question. I know we're going to hear calls from people who are not 100% satisfied with Obama. Fair enough. I'm not either. But don't kid yourself. The difference between these two guys is day and night. And we have got to do everything we can to see the Barack Obama elected president.
Yep. Amen. 27 minutes past the hour. Senator Bernie Sanders here with us. Sanders.Senate.gov, his website. By the way, Bernie, I got a couple emails from people here saying that they're getting some errors trying to submit the form over there. You might want to ask your web guy to check into it.
Okay.
Or it might just be an anomaly. We'll be right back with Bernie Sanders. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. It's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your call. Sanders.Senate.gov, his website, TomHartman.com. By the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, one of our new listeners in Texas, we're on live on a 50,000-watt station in Dallas, says, Bernie, can you be my senator surrogate? A few people, what is it, John Cornyn, the Republican from Texas? A few people not all that pleased, I guess.
Well, you have a chance to send him back to Texas this election.
That's right. That's right. And the name of his challenger escapes me at the moment. We've had him on our program before, and we're going to try and have him on again. And so, anyhow, Miriam in Miami, Florida, listening on WINS. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, me? Oh,
yes, you.
It's an honor to talk to both of you. I just wanted to ask you if you share my anger at the Democratic leadership at Dodd and Frank's the way I'm seeing is they have embraced the Paulson bailout plan with modifications and all of that. But basically, they've embraced, number one, the urgency of it, and that that's the only way to do it. When a whole slew of economists are saying there are other ways and put the brakes on and slow down. And now, the way I see it, the Republicans have taken that and said, you know, well, let's stop. And I think it's the worst thing that the Democrats have ever done. And I, is it just me?
No. As a matter of fact, I just made that point to Chris Dodd within the last hour. My wife in Burlington is a very good observer. She doesn't get caught up in the turmoil of D.C. and she's sitting home watching the TV. And her perception is, in fact, that it is now the Democrats who are being identified with Bush's bailout program. While the right-wing Republicans are out there saying we're going to protect taxpayers from Wall Street, I share that concern. There are going to be some meetings today, and I will continue to voice that perspective. I think what the Democrats have got to say is, number one, we should be thinking thoughtfully about this. It is not clear that we have to move in quite the time frame that Mr. Paulson has suggested. And number two, bottom line is, if a bailout is to occur, the people and the class of people who caused the problem pay for it. And the Democrats, while Bonnie Frank, to his credit, has supported the concept and been vocal on the concept. I was just on a show with him on NPR the other day where he repeated his thought that there should be a surtax on the very wealthy. But we're not seeing that in the plan, and that's what they've got to fight. As you know, Tom, in the House, Peter DeFazio, a very good friend of mine I work with many years in the House, is proposing a stock transfer tax of a quarter of 1%, which would raise, I believe, about $150 billion a year. And in that sense, what you're saying is let the stock market bail out the stock market. But either of those ideas make a lot of sense. Unfortunately, the Democrats have not embraced that yet.
Which, tragically, is exactly what you predicted would happen on this program.
Did I tell you that
Tuesday
last week?
Of this week, yes.
That's right.
You came on our show briefly, and I know you do a lot of media, and just said, I said, could this be the October surprise? And you said, I don't know about that, but the Democrats are going to end up, words to the effect of, the Democrats are going to end up painted as being in Bush's side, and the Republicans will take the other side, and they lose again. Anyhow, Rob in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Rob, you're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yeah, I was just, Senator Sanders, I'd like you to know that I've steered over 150 emails steering the people, the recipients, to your website.
Thank you very much, Rob. Thank you.
No,
and you know what I'm going to do with that, by the way? If I have a chance, I'm going to be on the floor of the Senate this afternoon, doing my best to get onto the floor to start reading some of those emails, because what we're hearing from people in Vermont and throughout this country is just right on. I mean, people have been writing very, very thoughtful emails, analyzing the problem and expressing a point of view that I think the U.S. Senate should be hearing.
Yeah, and in addition, I've called Reid, Pelosi, John Boehner even, just following up, but I'd like to get your opinion. As far as Reaganomics come home to roost, the public outcry seems palpable, but, and as a previous caller stated, and you followed up on, simply put, what's your opinion of the public outcry, and why are the constituencies, seems to be, we're being ignored?
The public outcry, I mean, this is my perception, Rob. This is, on one hand, an enormously complicated issue, because there aren't three people in the world who understand these very new and exotic financial tools in which trillions of dollars are being invested and sold, and nobody understands that. But this is what people do understand, and they understand it emotionally, and they understand it intellectually. And what they understand is that for many years now, being in the middle class, they are hurting. They're losing their health insurance, they're losing their pensions. You now need two people in a family, two adults in a family, to bring home the money to pay for the bills. We're seeing millions of working families now having to line up at emergency food shelves because their limited income is not enough to pay for food even. That's what people are perceiving. And then they know. I mean, they don't have all the facts and figures, and certainly the media does not give it to them. But they understand that on the other side of town, you have people who are building yachts that are incredibly long. You will have people who are making money hand over fist. And they understand that these people, especially the folks on Wall Street, have caused this problem. So you don't have to be a PhD in economics to say, you know, it's just not fair for me, who is struggling to keep my head above water, to be bailing out the excesses of these billionaires and millionaires who have made out like bandits. And people are furious. Now, people will disagree what we should do. How do we go from here to there? But that, I think, is emotionally where people are coming from.
James in New Paltz, New York. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Greetings, gentlemen. I'm so glad to speak to both of you. Two quick questions. One may sound kind of silly, but I was wondering if this, whatever, however this plan proceeds, if we could just call it the Grover Norquist plan. I just want that man's legacy somehow to be called into attention.
Yep.
And my second question, is it possible we could tie this into repealing Gramm-Leach? Because I believe that was one of the problems.
Yep.
I know, Tom, you've talked about this religiously.
Yeah. Yep. All right, excellent questions, James. What James is talking about is Grover Norquist is a leading right-wing theorist who has argued for years that one way to make sure that the government is unable to fund Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans' needs, basically all of the programs that low- and moderate-income Americans depend upon, one way to do it is to drive the national debt up so high that any president will come in and say, look, you know, we got to, if this $700 billion bailout goes through, the national debt will be over $11 trillion. That is a lot of money. And then any president comes in and say, well, my God, you know, we just can't afford to do anything. I got to cut this. I got to cut that. I got to cut that. So what James is saying is this an effort to kind of handcuff a President Obama from being able to carry out his campaign promises to strengthen the middle class, to rebuild the infrastructure, to move us from fossil fuels to sustainable energy? Is this an effort to do that? And a lot of us are thinking about that, James. The other point that James raises is that one of the reasons that many of us believe we are where we are today with the financial system in so much trouble is deregulation. And the key deregulation legislation for financial services was called Gramm-Leach-Bliley. Phil Gramm being then the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee and the leading exponent of deregulation in financial services and in energy markets as well. And I should reiterate again what I've said before. Everybody should know that Phil Gramm was the economic advisor to John McCain, and many people thought that he would be McCain's Secretary of Treasury until he said some dumb things and McCain had to get rid of him. But they're very, very close. Should that be repealed? The answer is yes. We have got to, once more, as I mentioned earlier, go back to sensible regulation. You cannot have trillions of dollars floating around in the international monetary system without anybody knowing what's going on. So the answer, James, is yes.
Yeah. Okay, well said. Barbara in Sunrise, Surprise, Arizona, excuse me. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. Earlier you spoke about applying a surcharge to the top wealth of our country. Most of those individuals, aside from the ones that got the, quote, golden parachutes, have no earned income at all. Their income is derived from capital gains, dividends, and what have you. What would the surcharge be based on, and how could that be verified? How would we be able to actually implement a program of that type?
Well, Barbara, what I'm proposing would incorporate all of the income that these people earn, including capital gains.
So it's basically you take the bottom line on your tax return.
Absolutely.
Or the top line on your tax return before the deductions and things, and just
That's
say,
right.
You know, there you are. And that is that top percentage.
And the beauty of that, I mean, there's no system that is perfect. But the beauty of that is that it says, and what we're talking about, Barbara, again, is a five-year 10% surtax on income over $1 million a year for couples and over $500,000 a year for single taxpayers.
This is almost just rolling back the Bush tax cuts,
exactly.
Isn't it?
That's,
I mean, it's
right.
Not that we're talking about going back to a tax levels that are within spitting distance of during the Carter administration.
That's right. That is exactly correct. That's going from 35% to 45%.
Yeah. This is nothing like, you know, Franklin Roosevelt taking it up to 91% or John Kennedy 71%.
That's right.
45 minutes past the hour. Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions at 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com for our live chat room, Sanders.Senate.gov for Bernie Sanders.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Helping you in the water cooler wars, the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Sydney in Arizona. Hey, Sydney.
Hi, how you doing? Hey, both of y'all.
Good.
I'm a truck driver, and my salary hasn't went up in over 5 years now. They're making the same thing for the last 5 years. Now, all of the companies on Wall Street, I know they've made billions, if not trillions of dollars, hand over fist. Assuming that they didn't burn it, what happened to all that money?
One thing that has happened is over the last 8 years, there has been a huge transfer of wealth from you, Sydney, from truck drivers and working people all over this country to the wealthiest 1%. And you now have a situation where, conservatively speaking, the richest, the top 1% of income earners now earn more money than do the bottom 50%. And that gap between the very rich and everybody else is growing wider, and the top 1% own more wealth than the bottom 90%. And what we have seen on the top in recent years is just a huge increase in the number of millionaires and billionaires. So that's where that money has gone. Now, money is disappearing when the stock market goes down 500 points in a day. Wealth disappears. But there has been a huge transference of wealth from working families to the top 1% since Bush has been in.
And then we see Halliburton move its headquarters to Dubai, and all the executives moving over there, and probably Dick Cheney will when he leaves office.
Right. I mean, you know, when these guys...
It's moving offshore.
All that these guys think about, and this is an issue, you know, Tom, maybe we deserves a whole show to discuss, is the culture that we're currently living under, where greed is really their religion. Whereas you've indicated, the heads of large corporations like Halliburton, this is the vice president of the United States' former company, leaving the United States of America because they don't want to pay taxes in this country.
Right, and still taking hundreds of billions of dollars in federal contracts.
I mean, it is unbelievable. But we don't even make a big deal about it because so what? We expect that every large corporation will run to the Cayman Islands, they'll run to Bermuda in order to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. Why do they have to pay taxes when you got truck drivers, you know, like Sydney, who's not making any money? They're paying their taxes. So you got an incredible amount of a culture of greed out here, which we have got to fundamentally address.
Yeah, well said. We should devote a program to it. Linda, maybe when things settle down a bit. Linda in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Linda, you're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi there. Hi. I have to say that I'm outraged at this extortion. The secret meeting with the congressional leaders, I think, was a shakedown. And these guys, these Republicans, are desperate to get Democratic hands on this Republican mess. So what I want to say is it possible to convince Harry Reid to have an alphabetical roll call vote to put these crooks on the hook? And if the Republicans refuse,
what do you mean by it? What do you mean?
That the Democrats should walk away from it and do not pass anything.
Well, I don't know. I'm not clear what you mean by a roll call vote.
Well, by you call the state and the senator comes.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Well, you do that here on things like this. There will be a roll call vote. Every senator's vote will be known on any bailout, that I can tell you. I think, you know, Linda is raising the question that a caller made earlier, Tom, and mm-hmm. the fear is that Bush comes up with a disastrous policy. The Democratic leadership takes ownership of it, makes it a lot better and more responsible, but now has ownership of it, and Republicans are then running away and saying, why do the Democrats want to bail out Wall Street?
Right.
And I think Linda's point from a political perspective is exactly correct, and it's something that I fear very much.
Yeah. Sheila in Eugene, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello?
Hi.
Yeah. You called for Sheila?
I did. You're on the air.
Okay. I had a comment and probably a question. The comment is this is going about bailing out Wall Street is the wrong way. The right way, it seems to me, is to bail out the people who have been wounded by these shenanigans on Wall Street, and they give them jobs, establish with some of the money a work program to rebuild the infrastructure of the country, get people on to work again, and they can pay their mortgages. And it seems to me there's enough money left over for health care and a whole bunch of other stuff that we need in this country. Why can't it be done that way?
Seal makes a very good point. There is some effort to do that. In fact, right in the middle of this program, I'm down in the cloakroom here, I just voted for, I don't even know what the final vote was, what we call a stimulus package. It wasn't anywhere near enough. It was $52 billion. There was some money in it, not enough for infrastructure and a variety of other programs to help create jobs in this country. It was a good start. It didn't go quite far enough. I think Seal's point is one that many people of Keynesian mind are thinking about, and that is just think what $700 billion invested in our country, invested in infrastructure at a time when our bridges, our roads, our water systems, our wastewater plants, our rail system is collapsing. If you invested in that, you rebuild America, which is so important for the future. You create jobs. You move us away from fossil fuel to sustainable energy. Think about how important it is that we're not purchasing $700 billion a year of foreign oil, that we're cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions, dealing with global warming. That is huge. So I think Seal makes a very, very good point that we can stimulate the economy from the bottom on up by creating jobs and putting money into the hands of working people. And I essentially agree with Seal.
Yeah, well said. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Get on over there. You can sign his petition. And it's a great proposal. And you know, let folks know. Bernie, thanks so much for being with
good
us.
Good to be with again. You, Tom. Take care.
Always great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Robert Greenwald coming up on the show. And, of course, Anything Goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls throughout the rest of the day. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the New York Times is reporting, among others, McCain decides to participate in debates. So he is going to reveal some small part of himself in his thinking tonight, but there are other parts, some rather substantial other parts of McCain that are not available to you, me, or frankly even the news media. Robert Greenwald, one of my favorite people, a brilliant producer, a brilliant director, one of America's most important activists, and president, I believe, is the title of Brave New Films, bravenewfilms.org. The website is with us. Robert, do I have your title right?
Any title is okay with me.
Okay. Chief Cook and Bottle Washer and Head Big Cheese over at bravenewfilms.org. Robert, you are just, ever since you gave me the tour of what you're doing, you know, I went down to L.A. and you gave me the guided tour, and it blew me away, and I've been watching your stuff on the web, this really deserves to be widely published. And actually, you don't even need me to widely publish. You got a couple hundred thousand, 300,000 people have seen this. McCain's health records must be released.
Well, and yesterday, I don't know if you followed it, but we know we're on to something about this campaign to have him release his records. We got attacked by Bill O'Reilly, Drudge, and Rush Limbaugh all in the same day, which is like,
that's wonderful,
winning the Golden Globe or an Oscar or something. But people, and of course, hopefully your listeners will take the video, send it around, get more doctors to sign up. When we started this campaign, Tom, we thought we might have 50, 75 doctors who would sign on saying that McCain should release his records. We now just passed 2,500 who've signed on.
Wow.
So it's 2,500
physicians have said McCain should release his medical records. Now, give us some background on this, Robert Greenwald. First of all, how has John McCain spent 26 years in the Senate without us having some relatively continuous sense of how, or at least the citizens of Arizona, I mean, haven't they asked for this kind of thing?
They have not. He's been very good, and his campaign's been very smart about limiting the release. And they, in fact, even some knowledgeable colleagues in the press, when we started this campaign, they said, oh, he's released it, hasn't he? And I said, no, he gave you a peek at it. It's 1,500 pages. They let the reporters into a room for 2 or 3 hours, no photographs, no cell phones, and that was it. And so when we started the campaign, I felt, and my colleagues all felt, let's focus on getting to release the records. Well, as the doctors have started weighing in, and the oncologists and the cancer specialists, over and over again, they're telling us that the problem is much more severe because he has what's called regressive recurring melanoma, which is a high-risk melanoma.
And melanoma is one of the deadliest cancers that there is, period.
Exactly. And that some of them, you know, his doctor said, well, it's skin cancer. No, it's melanoma. And there's a big debate among our doctors which kind of melanoma is it.
Right.
And they're all pretty convinced that it's 3 or 4, which is the most serious.
Right, and melanoma can pop up anywhere, although it very often starts on the skin. My son-in-law's mother right now is dying of melanoma of the lungs. She has lung cancer, and it's a melanoma. It metastasized to her lungs.
Yeah,
I don't know if she's dying of it, but she's very, very sick. And
yeah.
So, in any case, this is serious stuff, and John McCain has had it several times. Right, it's come back.
He's had it. That's why they say regressive recurring, and the fact that it's been dormant for a while means virtually nothing with the melanoma. And the video that we put together with the cancer doctors, which people can get at Brave New Films or at therealmccain.com, that has the doctor showing a graph and a chart. And what we're asking people to do is spread it not just to their friends, but try to go to their local media. Try to go to a local TV or radio station, or try to get a doctor in your community to write an op-ed about it. I mean, there's tremendous interest and desire to do the right thing here. We have a bunch of Republican doctors. We have independent doctors who've signed this. So there's an opportunity to raise a profound issue. And, of course, underlying this is the true nightmare that thinking about Sarah Palin really is being president of the United States.
Yeah, every time she makes her interviews with Katie Couric now, it's painful to watch them. I'm embarrassed for her, sorry for her, frankly. She clearly doesn't have either the intellectual horsepower to appropriately deal with the issues or any understanding of the issues themselves. I mean, it's really scary.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's one of the values of this campaign is to raise an issue that absolutely should be raised, and to do it in a way where it's obviously we have our issues and we care about things, but to raise it in a way where we can have the largest group of folks agreeing with us, saying, yeah, even if I want to vote for John McCain for president, I have a right to know what is the condition of his health. When you go to apply for any job, when you go to apply, as one of our doctors says, to become an airline pilot, you damn well got to tell the company what your physical situation is. John
right.
McCain wants the people of the United States to hire him.
I understand he's taking 6 different medications right now.
Well, at the minimum, and then there's question about that, how many medications. We know he's on, among other things, Ambien, the sleeping medication. I mean, think about the 3 a.m.
Oh, really?
Think about the 3 a.m. phone call taking that.
Yeah, that was what Patrick Kennedy took and got in his car and was driving around the Capitol in his bathrobe. I mean, you know, it's...
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, well, it was Ambien and a little bit of alcohol, I guess.
Yeah, but,
he was having a problem with both, but it's... Yeah. I mean, that's... The, oh, man. Now, the Associated Press reported recently that in February that McCain had another cancer removed.
Yes, they've been very... careful about limiting the announcement, limiting people's access. And I think we all have to push hard to get those answers. We're asking people to email to the debates, which are now on again, asking the moderators to bring it up as a question again. That you don't have to say he has something, but you do have to say, why won't you let us see the records?
Right. We're talking with Robert Greenwald, producer, director, activist, BraveNewFilms.org, TheRealMcCain.com. Robert, a couple of days ago, I think it was on Tuesday or Wednesday of this week, John McCain sat at a table with a number of, I don't know if they were described as his financial advisors, but financial luminaries, among them Mitt Romney, the guy who made hundreds of millions of dollars buying companies up and then offshoring their jobs or you know, pumping and dumping them. And one of them was one of the guys that you made a video about. Were you aware of this?
No. Oh, Henry Kravitz?
It was either Henry Kravitz or one of his compatriots.
It'd probably be Kravitz because he's a big McCain supporter.
Yeah. Well, it was one of those two or three, you know, multi gazillionaire guys who have been in the private equity business. And I remember, you know, seeing the thing. It was just a little clip on the news, just kind of flew by, and I said, I think that's the guy that Robert Greenwald did the video about. Tell us about, anyhow, that video and how people can find that, because that's mind-blowing.
Yeah. We did a campaign about private equity, helping to explain it to people, and we focused on Henry Kravitz, who makes $58,460 an hour, and we juxtapose it with real workers and what they make, and the whole inequities in the private equity system. And if you go to the Brave New Films website, up in the upper left-hand corner, you see the various campaigns. And that's part of our War on Greed campaign, which obviously is very relevant right now, and we'll be doing more and more of those very soon. You know, right now, you probably have this problem too, Tom, with the show. There's so much going on, and when you're in this universe, you're trying to figure out, with limited resources, where do you put your time and where do you focus people. And with us doing videos, it takes longer too. So we want to get. I very much want to get back to the war on greed and everything that's going on. So this Sunday, we will be putting out a video. We're working on it right now about John McCain's economy plans, if you will.
Yeah, and you know this, because I mean, this is the drama we're seeing played out right now, with this whole bank thing. You know, this is really the greedy war on us coming back to bite us. You know, coming to fruition. So, bravenewfilms.org, right?
Yeah.
If bravenewfilms.org, there's just a wealth of really really fine information over there that Robert Greenwald has compiled and put together that you should know about. You should be checking out. But the other campaign, therealmccain.com, let's have John McCain release his health records. Hundreds of thousands of people have now signed on to this. You can too, including over 2,500 medical doctors. Why won't McCain tell us about the state of his health, particularly with this tragically inexperienced and apparently incompetent woman as his vice presidential candidate, nominee, whatever. It's scary. Robert Greenwald, one of the finest people out there, one of the best producers, directors, and activists in the country. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There is no suspense or mystery. The White House rewrites our history now. Heaven knows that anything goes. CEOs with shady practices offshore evade their taxes, so no one knows that anything goes.
Well, speaking of anything goes, by the way, welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting. This is amazing. The McCain campaign accidentally released a web campaign ad this morning. This morning, before they announced that McCain was even going to participate in the debate, called McCain Wins the Debate. Yeah. They have since withdrawn it. Amazing. By the way, the Tom Hartman program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.org for more information. Greg in Hollandale, is it Hollandale Beach, Florida?
Yes, Tom, how
hey,
are you?
Hey, Greg, I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Great. I just want to thank you. Every day I listen to you, it's like sitting in one of the best political science classes that I ever had in college. It's just so enlightening.
Thank you, Greg. I would call myself the doctor of democracy, but some other guy already claimed that, so we got to come up with something else. Anyway,
hey,
what's up?
Two things concern me. One is last night, which I hate listening to Fox, but I turn it on after I'm done with all Oberman and everyone else I love to listen to, but they had Dick Morris on Fox last night.
Mm-hmm.
He was predicting how McCain's going to flip this, crush Obama, and say that he held this up and that the Republicans were against this, and Obama rushed it in, and you could reach him by phone, and that the Democrats have just, you know, cost the taxpayers the $700 billion agree to it. The other thing is,
I think he's right, Greg.
The other thing is, this morning was an interview with Obama's senior advisor. They said he was Stephanie Cutter. And they're saying that Joe Biden put in $45 million of earmarks into this as well. So I don't know if you heard anything on any of this, but
I don't know about the Biden earmarks. I'll have to hit some of the right-wing websites. I'm sure they'll be all over that. But the point of, and this is what Bernie came on the show on Tuesday and talked about. We blogged about it. I put an article up about it we tried to get on the homepage of AirAmerica.com. It ended up on the Tom Hartman page over at AirAmerica.com. And we certainly put it on our homepage at TomHartman.com, was that this could be the October surprise. This could be the thing that binds George Bush to Barack Obama and allows John McCain to say he's got nothing to do with George Bush. Is if the Bush plan is embraced by the Democrats, even lukewarm by Obama, but broadly by the Democrats, and is rejected by the Republicans, but something else has worked out and they call it their own, then political hell will be paid by the Democrats, I'm telling you. And frankly, I think it's already happening. And it's once again, the Republicans are playing chess and the Democrats are playing checkers. Michael in Virginia. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
Fine. What's up?
I had a couple questions for you. First off, I wanted to say it's an honor to actually be able to talk to you. But the second thing is I had a question in regards to the bailout. I was wondering, you know, why isn't the Senate focusing more on bailing out mortgages as opposed to bailing out CEOs of Wall Street that had shady business practices? I mean, isn't the working class what this country's built on?
It is.
And it just seems egregious to me that people are losing their houses, and that's not even a front-running concern anymore.
I agree. And if the Democrats had any spine at all, and if they understood political theater at all, that's where they would have started. They would have said to the Bush administration right out of the box, sorry, this is a no-go. We've got an alternative proposal. Ours will work better. And they would have created something like the Resolution Trust, or something, you know, and they would have said, we will start by bailing out Main Street and Wall Street can take care of itself, or we'll figure out a way that Wall Street can pay for its own bailout, is what Peter DeFazio is suggesting, what I wrote about it today at the top of commondreams.org. Yeah, absolutely. The problem is that the leadership of the Democratic Party, the both in the House and the Senate, both Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, are suffering from battered wife syndrome. They just, you know, the Republicans, you know, it's like, you know, spank me again, sir. I mean, I'm just astounded by it. I watch this over and over and over again. Here we have, you know, back in 2002, and thanks, Michael, for raising the topic. Back in 2002, you had the 6 weeks before Congress was out, or maybe it was even 4 weeks. The timing was almost identical almost identical. And in the summer, they had asked, you know, we had said, and this is 2002, the election in 2002, in the summer, some reporter asked Andrew Card, you know, are you guys going to try and go to war against Saddam Hussein? And he said, hey, you don't roll out a product until the fall. And sure enough, in the fall, they rolled out the product and they said, oh, it's hysterical, it's terrible, it's, you know, he's got these unmanned aerial drones that can drop nukes and chemical and biological weapons on the United States, and it represents an imminent threat, and hysteria, and vote. And they stampeded, and in the House of Representatives, the majority of the Democrats said no. But in the Senate, the majority of the Democrats said yes. They wimped out, they fell over. And, you know, okay, so they got suckered once in 2002. But, you know, this is, and then they did it again with the Patriot Act. And then they did it again with the Defense Appropriation Bill, the John Warner Defense Appropriation Bill that did away with posse comitatus. And then they did it again. You know, it's been over and over and over again with these guys. And you would think that the Democrats would figure it out. You'd think that they would learn how to do some friggin' political theater of their own. Take a lesson from Newt Gingrich.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, Mike Huckabee is calling out John McCain's campaign strategy. His strategy, of course, was...
There's no need to fear. Underdog is here.
Yes, Underdog flies to the rescue. See, he was falling behind in the polls, and so he was the underdog, and so he decided to parachute into the Washington, D.C. and say he's going to save Wall Street. Yeah. Huckabee says, and by the way, this is from Fox News. Huckabee said he still backs McCain's candidacy, but said the Arizona senator should not have put his campaign on hold to deal with the financial crisis on Wall Street. He said a president must be prepared to deal with the unexpected. You can't just say, world, stop for a moment. I'm going to cancel everything, Huckabee said, kind of echoing David Letterman. And it's so true. Okay, John McCain, apparently you can't walk and chew gum at the same time. By the way, I want to just toss out a meme here, and then we'll go to your phone calls here for the rest of the day, but other than our report from Talk Radio News. But let me just toss this out, and you're welcome to comment on it, or not. Yesterday, was it yesterday or the day before yesterday, when Barack Obama was talking about, I guess it was the day before yesterday, Barack Obama was talking about how he had his news conference and he said, you know, I think this is a time that it's even more important for Americans to hear from the candidates in the face of this crisis. And he said a president has to be able to do more than one thing at once. And Louise and I are sitting there watching it, on the couch, and I'm jumping up and I'm yelling at the TV screen, which, on the other side of the room, I'm yelling, chew gum and walk. Walk and chew gum. Come on, tell him we can walk and chew gum. And it's like I'm trying to give him one-liners, right? I'm trying to give Barack Obama, and instead he says, you know, it's important that a president be able to do more than one thing at a time. And this is and it took him three sentences to say it. And I was just so upset that he missed an opportunity to do a zinger, because I knew that zinger would become the soundbite that all the media would take. And then after it was over, CNN and MSNBC, and those were the only two that I was watching, were playing clips of Obama. And instead of, I know how to walk and chew gum at the same time, which is what I was suggesting, in my living room. Instead, they actually played a two or three sentence clip from him. And Louise turned to me and she said, you know, maybe, as I recall her words, she said, maybe you're wrong. maybe Barack Obama should just be Barack Obama. And maybe it's okay to have a smart guy as, you know, running for president. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I mean, I suddenly remembered, I'm old enough to remember John Kennedy running for president. I mean, I was a little kid at the time. I was 9 years old in 1960, but I remember it. I was very interested in it. And most of us were, frankly, because at the age of 7 and 8, we were diving under our desks once a week when the alarm went off and covering our eyes and our ears because the Soviets were going to nuke us. I mean, I'm telling you, growing up as a little kid during the Cold War, I was very aware of politics, and many of my peers were. I think it's one of the reasons why my generation and people who are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s nowadays are so politically active. But in any case, John Kennedy did not speak in sound bites. He didn't speak in sound bites. I mean, he if he had something to say, he said it in he said it in the way that it needed to be said. I don't know how to say it beyond that, but you know, he laid things out in a way that was easy to understand, but wasn't a soundbite. And people say, well, you know, we've moved on. We're now a soundbite culture, blah, 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 blah. I don't know. I don't know. I think that, you know, when Kennedy, you know, for example, is talking about being a liberal.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with a taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
John F. Kennedy, during the campaign in 1960, I'm proud to say that I am that kind of a liberal. Arguably, that was a soundbite, but, you know, he didn't. And so I am reconsidering. I'm no longer yelling at the TV. I think Louise is absolutely right. I think that we need to let Obama be Obama. And also, I forget which one. I think it was Terry Jeffrey the other day, but it could have been another one of the conservatives that we have on this program said, you know, Barack Obama, he's an elitist. And I'm going to start responding to that whenever it comes up. And I would encourage you to do the same. I mean, let's take that frame and shove it down their throats. Kennedy was an elitist, I suppose, arguably, is somebody who looks down their nose at other people because they're part of the elite. And to Kennedy, I never got the sense that he was looking down his nose at anybody. But an elite I want as president. We have been so damaged by having the guy that you want to have a beer with, and frankly, that too many people had beers with as president. We have been so damaged by that. And this goes all the way back to Richard Nixon and his Checkers speech, where he talked about his wife having a cloth coat and him and the dog and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, he answered a Help Wanted ad that said, you know, veteran wanted to run for Congress in California. This is the California Republican Party when he first ran for the House of Representatives. He answered a Help Wanted ad. And he was, you know, he was kind of an average guy and turned out to be nuts. But Bush is the super example. And now Sarah Palin, another one, she can't string together a coherent sentence. Every time she does an interview, I'm finding myself feeling embarrassed and sorry for the poor woman. And that's not how you want to feel about the president of the United States or somebody who's one heartbeat, one 72-year-old melanoma carrying heartbeat away from the presidency of the United States. So when somebody says Barack Obama's an elitist, I'm going to say, you know, I'd like to see somebody who is elite as president. I want somebody who actually has an IQ above 100. I want somebody who was educated in a good college and who was a professor of constitutional law. Neither John McCain nor Sarah Palin have ever even been to a law school. They don't know how the law works, and yet we're going to put them in charge of the institution that runs our laws and creates our laws? The government of the United States of America? That's what happened with Cheney and Bush. Neither one of them are lawyers either. They don't have a clue. You say, well, it's unconstitutional. Oh, I don't care. Well, why doesn't Bush care? Because he's never read the Constitution. So I'm, you know, I love the fact that Barack Obama, he has humble beginnings. He, you know, his mom lived on food stamps. He came from, he's biracial. He's half white and half black. He's seen it all. He's been to hell and back through his lifetime as a kid. But he's elite, and God bless him for it. That is, he was able, with a brilliant intellect, to get himself through one of the very best schools in the world, to get a doctor's degree in law, to be a professor of law, to be the editor of the Harvard Law Review. He ran an organization, a Catholic Charities organization, in Chicago, and built up its budget, increased its staff hundreds of percent, made it a tremendous success. This is called community organizing. And then went on to be a senator, a state senator, and for a decade, and a United States senator. And he's done good stuff. I want that kind of an elite running our country. I don't want somebody who knows how to shoot a moose. I don't give a damn if they know how to shoot a moose. I don't care. Just don't care. Dave in Chicago. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. This Bush audio clip that you played from October 2002 about the Fannie and Freddie mortgages.
Yeah, I just put a link to it up on my homepage at TomHartman.com, by the way.
Okay, yeah, you can't do that enough. I called CNN, and I told them they might want to play that on the news tonight.
Yeah.
I bounce around on the radio, and these righties are spinning it that the Democrats, in their liberal ways, have everything to do with this.
Oh, I know. I've heard several of them, and they've got their talking points down, and the problem is that there is some small amount of truth to it. The Democrats were very concerned, and rightfully so, about the fact that minorities didn't have access to mortgages, but you know, they were not talking about undoing the restrictions. That was something that was promoted by the industry itself. It's not like and by the Republicans as well. And some Democrats.
I invite your listeners to call.
To what? Dave is gone. Okay. Dave, you could have finished your sentence. In any case, the bottom line is that it was industry and their massive lobbying funds that just pushed this thing through. McCain comes out of hibernation. If he sees his shadow, 6 more weeks of...
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Bonnie in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Bonnie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Hi. Thanks for what you do and for taking my call. I just feel so passionate about this, and I've been on hold for a long, long time this morning. Anyway, there's a private news network. It's online, and it's called the Real News Network. And there's a video clip today that's called Once in a Century Ripoff. And it basically, given the European reaction. Mm-hmm. And there's an economist on there by the name of Michael Hudson. And he's talking about how this will cause hyperinflation and the collapse of the dollar.
Yeah.
And that basically this is Bush's last ripoff, and he's entrusting the Dems by tricking them into pulling this off for him.
Yes. I absolutely agree with the analysis. I've read Hudson's article. I don't agree with every detail of it, but yes, this, and that's why I wrote the piece that's up at the top of commondreams.org. I last night I was exhausted. I had to, this morning I filled in for Carl Wolfson on KPOJ, so you know, I've been this is my fifth hour of nonstop radio today. And but I said I can't go to sleep until I get this thing done, and so I wrote this quick op-ed piece suggesting that let the damn financial services industry bail out themselves. There is precedent for it. There's an easy way to do it. We don't need to get hysterical about this. And I didn't get into the politics of it much. I mean, I opened with a paragraph about that. This is Grover Norquist's, wet dream. I mean, he's got to be so excited about this.
Exactly.
You know? And it's very simple. You put a 0.25%, 0.25% tax on every single financial transaction on the sale of stock, on the sale of bonds, on the sale of derivatives, on the sale of credit swaps, all these fancy instruments, and cause the market to stop, make it more difficult for people to engage in speculation and easier, frankly, for people to engage in investment. It's a good thing for the economy. It doesn't create new debt. It doesn't mean that the nation goes in deeper in debt. But yes, we're talking about 4% of GDP here, $800 billion.
Right.
And when you take 4% of GDP and you just go out and borrow it from anywhere in the world you can get it and start handing it over to people who created absolutely nothing, who are just running off with the profits, yes, you're going to destroy the dollar and there will be hyperinflation. Whether it's going to be, you know, the 20, 30, 50, 100, 1,000% type of inflation, or whether it's going to be, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20% inflation, I don't know, frankly, but there is going to be inflation as a result of this, and there is going to be a stagnant economy as a result of this. Look at what happened when LBJ tried to have the Vietnam War and the Great Society at the same time. It ran us into debt, and as a consequence of that, 10 years later, as that debt was working its way out of the system during the Carter administration and during the first years of the Reagan administration, you had inflation and recession. And that's what's kind of come all over again with the war and now this bailout and 30 years of Republican politics. And they're going to blame the Democrats on it. Absolutely.
Right.
They're doing it hysterically right now. You go to Google and you type in financial crisis caused by Democrats and you get over 250,000 hits right now.
Right.
I mean, it's every talk show host in the country right now is trying to play the blame game on this thing and pin the tail on the Democrats. But the simple reality is, and every American knows it, is that this is caused and has been caused. Yes, some Democrats have been complicit in it, but by and large, this has been caused by the Republican point of view that Reagan articulated.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
Yeah. About, you know, let's deregulate this thing. So Bonnie, I've got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. You spoke very well of the issue. I agree with you. Cliff in Ithaca, New York, listening to WNYY. Hey, Cliff.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. And by the way, I agree with Louise. And wanted to point out, too, that when John F. Kennedy went to Charles de Gaulle, no friend of America, to give proof about his Cuban Missile Crisis, de Gaulle said, "If the American president says it, I believe it. That's good enough for me."
Right.
We don't have that kind of credibility anymore.
that's absolutely right. But, yeah, we need a member of our elite, one of us, but one of the best of us, right, to be president of the United States, yeah, not another Joe Sixpack. Thank you very much.
Indeed. But the reason I called was basically this. I found a little Reuters dispatch on Buzzflash the other night, and it's only three sentences. Let me read it to you. Beijing, September 25th. Chinese regulators have told domestic banks to stop interbank lending to the U.S. financial institutions to prevent possible losses during the financial crisis, the South China Morning Post reported.
Yeah.
And the quote from the Post, the decree appears to be Beijing's first attempt to erect defenses against the deepening U.S. financial crisis, and the mainland's major lenders reported billions of U.S. dollars in exposure to the credit crisis.
Yeah, I read the actual original story on AsiaTimes.com. China has since denied that they said that, but nobody's believing it. We are reaching the end of our rope with regard to the ability to borrow from foreign people. And that's another reason why I think it's so important that if we do have to bail out banks, that we let them bail themselves out and we do it by a tax on banking activity or traders and trading activity, if you want to, you know, use the really precise terms. And that's why I suggested this 0.25% tax, this stock transaction tax, which we had in the United States from 1914 to 1966, and it worked. We used it to finance the Civil War and the Spanish-American War. England has it right now, the United Kingdom, 0.25% tax. Taiwan just reduced it from 0.6 down to 0.3% in an effort to stimulate their stock market. And, by the way, it didn't stimulate the stock market, nor would it depress the stock market. And
do you think this is the first blow in the death of the dollar?
Yes. I don't think it's the first blow. I think the dollar has been being killed ever since Ronald Reagan came into office. Look at our money supply. Look at our debt. Look at the explosion of debt. Ronald Reagan came into office, and our debt, our national debt, was less than $1 trillion. Now they just raised the debt ceiling to over $11 trillion to accommodate this thing. Are they talking about doing it? I mean, the rest of the world looks at that and says, hey, wait a minute, dollars?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. And it looks like anything goes with the debates. The debates are back on. McCain has blinked. He has been blinked. And so it is. It's going to be an interesting time tonight. Get ready. Get the, you know, beer, wine, whatever it is, Coca-Cola, herbal tea, your beverage of choice, some nachos or whatever, and get ready. I think we've invited our kids over tonight for a let's watch the debates party. It should be a good one. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Let's just get as many as we can in here. Jeff in Tacoma. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I got a couple of issues here. First things first, I believe what everybody else has been saying is that the Democrats are walking right into the biggest trap of the century.
Yep.
The $700 billion is the biggest bill that Congress has ever passed, will ever pass. It is the bill of the century. There is no reason to rush it. They should make sure the American people are on board.
Well, not only that, though, but the market is doing just fine right now, thank you very much. LIBOR is up. I mean, the interbank lending costs are front page of yesterday's Financial Times, up around 3%, but that's not going to kill the entire system.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm focused mainly on the mass appeal. I mean, what's going to move the most amount of voters? And the Democrats should be as well. I mean, the fact is they could have taken this thing from Bush, read it into the Senate record, whatever, as a joke and clowned on it. They should run against that three-page piece of trash. They should call it the American Dream Devastation Act or the Bury U.S. Homeowners Act.
And I guarantee you that's what the Republicans are going to do, Jeff. It's what they're already doing.
Act of 2008 and punish Bush with it and now they have the perfect opportunity because McCain went and stepped in it. He violated what the Republicans were planning, and he went back there and gave them an excuse to say, John McCain walked in here and screwed everything up. Now we have to start over from scratch, and we stuff FDR down their throats.
Yeah, well, I would, from your lips to God's ears, Jeff, unfortunately, I don't think the Democrats are going to do that. I think that what we're going to see is another spineless rollover. But let's... keep contacting. Callcongress.org is our website. By the way, somebody told me that the Common Dreams website is down right now. Sometimes when we mention a website on this program, they crash, and it's not some huge conspiracy. It's just that, we get 3 or 4 million listeners, and people hit a website like that, and they just crash it. And it's also over at TomHartman.com, the article that I wrote about how the financial services industry can pay for their own damn bailout without costing any of us a penny, and it'll actually be a good thing for the economy, something we should have done a long time ago anyway, something, in fact, we did do a long time ago. Eva in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Eva.
Oh, hi, Mr. Hartman. This is Eva Hart,
mm-hmm.
and I used to be in the Army, and I got in on the end of the phone line. May I switch to another subject?
Sure.
Yeah,
you can talk about anything you want.
Huh?
Anything you want. Anything goes Friday.
Okay, fine. Well, I wanted, and it pertains to your book, Screwed of the Middle Class, as well as this Wall Street bailout crisis. From Eleanor Lebeau's book, he's a Jewish anthropologist, from his 93 book. And let me preface it quickly by saying that I'm sorry to hear about your sister, but he writes in his book that he had terminal cancer, and yet he found drugs in Quebec, Canada, that prolonged his life for years.
Yeah.
Let me say the quote from his book. He talks to you about how poverty points to major system failures at lower and sometimes middle levels of our wage labor hierarchy. Mm. Then he points out that homelessness results in the lowering of standard of living of the American workers. Wanted to say that. I want to add in Devereaux's book, The Government of Free Nation, that she says that in a democracy, the employer and employee both have rights. Finally, just wanted to get your opinion on this now, too. And I think you brought up this point. Dr. Elliot Lebeau's book, he says in it that from Donald L. Wood, quoted from Washington Post, April 4, 89, he states that, and you mentioned this, Ms. Hartman, I believe last week, raising the minimum wage to its buying power for many years and addressing it to inflation.
Right.
And raising the earned income tax credit would help, you know, our economy.
Yep.
Entitled, if you work, you shouldn't be poor. What do you think about that, Ms. Hartman?
Eva, thank you very much. I absolutely agree. Right across the board. Every economy grows from the bottom up. It never grows from the top down. And we've had top-down economics. They call it trickle-down economics. They called it Reaganomics ever since 1980. We had top-down economics from 1920 to 1932. It produced the Republican Great Depression. We've had it from 1981, from the beginning of the Reagan administration until today, with a brief interruption during the Clinton years in some ways, in some regards, in many regards, frankly. But just a brief interruption. And we're back to trickle-down economics. And you know, I know it's a lousy joke and a terrible pun, but trickle-down economics does nothing more than produce a nation of peons, period. There's just no other way to say it. Manuel in Beaverton. Hey, Manuel.
Hi, how's it going, Tom? Thanks
Good.
For taking my call.
Thank you. Oh, and apropos of Eva's call, I don't have a sister. It wasn't my sister I was talking about with cancer. It's my son-in-law's mother, but I shouldn't probably drag personal examples into things anyway.
Okay.
So, Manuel, what's up?
I had two questions. One, in the midst of paying attention to the $700 billion bailout, mm-hmm. I think people might have missed that there's a $25 billion bailout of the automakers going on. I think it's either approved or in the process of being approved. And I'm concerned that we're distracted with the $700 billion that we might be missing other kind of bailouts happening.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that, you know, when somebody murders somebody, you know, they consider a murder or kill somebody, they're a murderer. But when you kill millions of people, you're considered a conqueror. And then so if somebody comes and robs a bank, they're considered a bank robber. But what do you call it when somebody robs a nation of its wealth?
Right. You call them a venture capitalist, or you call them a private equities trader, or you call yeah, absolutely, very very well said, Manuel. And yes, they are bailing out the auto manufacturers, and the rationale is, hey, these are companies that are too big to fail. They're our last domestic industries. If we ever need to make tanks, we need them, et cetera, et cetera. And those are all true things, but they're not addressing the structural problems. The problem is what we need to say. What brought us to this? And what brought us to the economic crisis that we're facing, to the extent that there is one? I mean, let's remember, these are the same guys who told us Iraq was going to drop anthrax on us. Remember that Saddam Hussein had this cadre of unmanned aerial vehicles that at any moment could be dropping. I mean, you know, Bush and his war lies. I mean, it's. I'll have to find these things. And here we are right here. I mean, these are the same people who told us this kind of stuff. I mean, this is just.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
They're going to bring biological weapons to the United States. That was how George Bush was selling this thing 6 years ago now, right? The war in Iraq. And what he was talking about was they had aerial photographs of two balsa wood model airplanes that Uday and Kusay played with. So is there a financial crisis? I don't know. I honestly don't know. But to the extent that there may be, as a result of fraud, let's deal with the fraud. Let's deal with the deregulation, and then let's figure out a way for Wall Street to bail itself out if it needs to be bailed out. With regard to the auto industry, you want to protect the domestic auto industry. Instead of giving them $25 billion, you could loan it to them over the short term. How about putting up some trade tariffs to prevent or to make foreign cars more expensive in the United States and give an edge to your domestic auto manufacturers, like we did for 200 years, like China does right now, like Japan does right now, like Korea does right now, like Taiwan does right now, like Brazil does right now, like India does right now. Why don't we do that? I mean, it's pretty straightforward stuff. You simply say, if you want to have a domestic industry of any kind, we don't make socks in the United States anymore. We don't make T-shirts in the United States anymore. We don't make shirts. We don't make pants. Levi Strauss, the all-American company, they shut down their last American factory about 5 years ago. I mean, we don't make any of these things in the United States anymore. Why? It's not some weird coincidence. It's because we changed the laws of the game of trade. We changed the rules. And businesses tend to play by the rules. They look at the rules and they say, okay, under these rules, how can I gain the maximum advantage? And starting with Ronald Reagan, we changed the rules of trade to say, you know, if you do your manufacturing overseas, you'll make more money. And in fact, you can avoid even paying taxes on the money you make. Let's change the rules back to rules that worked for us. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything goes, 20 minutes past the hour. Well, Sarah Palin, absolutely incoherent. I mean, this is frightening.
Why isn't it better, Governor Palin, to spend $700 billion helping middle-class families who are struggling with health care, housing, gas, and groceries? Allow them to spend more and put more money into the economy instead of helping these big financial institutions that played a role in creating this mess.
Now, notice Katie Couric's questions are coherent. Listen to the reply.
That's why I say I, like every American I'm speaking with, we're ill about this position that we have been put in, where it is the taxpayers looking to bail out. But ultimately, what the bailout does is help those who are concerned about the health care reform that is needed to help shore up our economy, it's got to be all about job creation, too, shoring up our economy and putting it back on the right track. So health care reform and reducing taxes and reining in spending has got to accompany tax reductions and tax relief for Americans. And trade, we've got to see trade as opportunity, not as a competitive, scary thing, but 1 in 5 jobs being created in the trade sector today. We've got to look at that as more opportunity. All those things under the umbrella of job creation.
What? It's this person wants to be vice president of the United States. Katie Couric asked her about her foreign policy.
You've cited Alaska's proximity to Russia as part of your foreign policy experience. What did you mean by that?
That Alaska has a very narrow maritime border between a foreign country, Russia, and on our other side, the land boundary that we have with Canada. It's funny that a comment like that was kind of made to
caricature?
Reporters.
Mocked.
Yeah, mocked, I guess that's the word, yeah.
Well, explain to me why that enhances your foreign policy credentials?
Well, it certainly does, because our next-door neighbors are foreign countries. They're in the state that I am the executive of. And
have you ever been
involved
with any negotiations, for example, with the Russians?
We have trade missions back and forth. We do. It's very important when you consider even national security issues with Russia, as Putin rears his head and comes into the airspace of the United States of America, where do they go? It's Alaska. It's just right over the border. It is from Alaska that we send those out to make sure that an eye is being kept on this very powerful nation, Russia, because they are right there. They are right next to our state.
Aren't you reassured? I know I am. Amy in San Diego. Hey, Amy. Amy? No, Amy. Ben in Queens, New York. Hey, Ben, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hey, Tom. How you doing? I'm calling about the J.P. Morgan WaMu buyout.
Yeah.
I hear WaMu had $188 billion in assets.
I haven't seen the numbers.
Well, I haven't checked it, but that's what I heard. And J.P. Morgan bought them for $1.5 billion. Which is less than a penny on the dollar?
Well, you can have, you know, $100 million in assets, but if you have $102 million in liabilities, then, you know...
I heard the debt gets
you're
erased.
Not worth the dollar.
The debt doesn't get erased in their buyout.
The liabilities?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so, no. They're not declaring... Well, maybe they are declaring bankruptcy. Actually, it's a failed bank.
I was wondering if we rescue them, will we get a deal like that?
Yeah, yeah. you know, I don't want to speak off the top of my head here about this, Ben, and I frankly have not seen all the details on the buyout, so I don't know. But, you know, I guess, you know, I think the probabilities are fairly high at the risk of sounding like Sarah Palin here. talking about something I don't know the details of. But I would bet that J.P. Morgan got a deal, or they wouldn't have done the deal. Number one, or maybe they got a little, you know, maybe they got a little help from their friends in the federal government. But on the other hand, I mean, the good news is for the people who are WaMu depositors.
I have a WaMu mortgage. Am I going to get anything off?
Yeah. Well, yeah. If your mortgage got sold for
how much I get off?
Yeah, if your mortgage got sold for, well, it's probably more likely 80 cents on the dollar or something like that, then why couldn't you have bought it? I mean, those are the kind of questions that should be being asked. Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Thank you. Bob in Miami. Hey, Bob, got a break coming here in a minute. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, yeah, you, Stephanie Miller, Randy Rhodes, Mike Malloy have all now stated that a coup d'etat is a real possibility.
A coup d'etat happened in 2000.
I called you a few months ago and asked you if George W. has the same fascist dream as his great-grandfather of overthrowing it. How did he do this? And you kind of drew a blank. But, Tommy, I quickly explained how easily the Bush and his fascist buddies can accomplish this.
You got 30 seconds.
Oh, wow. Okay, in a few weeks, the fascists will begin a massive bombing campaign in Iran, and that's not just to take their oil, but in hopes of destabilizing the Muslim world, which in all likelihood will cause World War III. And they want to coincide that with a complete meltdown of the economy. At home, we're going to find out there's not enough money to cover everyone's money in the bank. That will cause huge panic and huge state of shock. That'll cause a fuel shortage. That will cause a food shortage. And at that point, Bush imposes martial law. And you'll see a massive disruption to internet and phones, very limited communication with each other. Most radio and TV stations will be pulled down, and you're pretty much going to see state-run propaganda news. Welfare benefits will cease, and the propaganda machine will report prison breakouts.
Bob, I'm sorry, we're out of time. It's literally the bottom of the hour, and it's a break I can't stop. But... you know, your scenario has a small possibility of being real.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
33 minutes past the hour. Taking back the corporate media, the mainstream media, becoming the mainstream media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. The Tom Hartman radio program, live noon to 3 Eastern time, 9 to noon Pacific time, and occasionally time delayed or moved around from place to place. Okay, Sue in the chat room, Sue Nethercutt, who runs our chat room over at tomhartman.com, if you want to drop in and say hi. It's free, it's open to anybody, as are our message boards, as is our video stream, as is the live audio stream as well. You can find it all linked to over at tomhartman.com and at airamerica.com. Sue Nethercutt writes, J.P. Morgan, she's quoting from a news story, J.P. Morgan won't acquire WaMu's liabilities, including claims by shareholders and subordinated and senior debt holders, the FDIC said. So apparently we are subsidizing J.P. Morgan's acquisition of Washington Mutual. Again, I want to learn more about this before I go off on a rant about it, but it doesn't. I don't like that. What can I say? I mean, you know, it's just, man, it's, how about bailing out me? How about bailing out you? I mean, you know, where's the bailout of America? Mario in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Mario.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Great show. I want to tell you why this bailout is bad.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why. First of all, the Treasury Secretary Paulson has been planning this emergency bailout for 6 months now. It's not just something that happened overnight.
Right. Well, we know that this document has been in existence for 4 months.
And when the Federal Reserve bailed out AIG, Tom, there was no more money left in the Federal Reserve. Now, when Treasury Secretary Paulson gets all the money in the U.S. Treasury, there will be no more money left. And when he gives it all to Wall Street, it won't circulate back into the economy. It will just evaporate into the hands of the fat cats of Wall Street. And from then on, the Federal Reserve will just print money with no gold to back it up. Yeah. Then the price of everything will double overnight. The value of the dollar will plummet, which will then force the federal government to get all the money from the Social Security reserves.
Yeah,
and
no, Mario, yes and no. I mean, let me just toss a couple of caveats into what you said. Number one, the money will evaporate, but much of it is going to evaporate into China and Saudi Arabia and the United Kingdom and all the countries where we've tapped out the ability to borrow money domestically.
Exactly.
So it is going to evaporate. It's going to go offshore, number one. Number two, the extent to which this is going to debase our currency, keep in mind we already have a $9 trillion debt. This is adding roughly another $1 trillion, maybe $1.5 trillion when you include interest and everything onto that debt. So it's going to increase by about 10% the debasement of our currency, not 100% or 1,000%. So the prices aren't going to double, but they are going to go up. I agree with you on that. And they're going to jury-rig the books just like they always do, so that people who are living on Social Security or fixed incomes get screwed, and people who are the investor class who make their money off, who are basically buying this debt and we will be paying the interest to, that they'll do very well, thank you very much. The investor class wins, the working class gets screwed, and
exactly.
So by and large, I'm absolutely in agreement with your analysis. I would quibble a little bit on a couple of the details. Mario, well said. Thank you very much. Art in Seattle. Hey, Art.
Hello, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine, I think.
Good. I'm talking to my cousin in Houston, actually just north of Houston.
Yeah.
Okay? He tells me a great joke. He says a Gallup pollster asked this 75-year-old rancher what he thinks about Sarah Palin as McCain's choice for vice president. So the old rancher says, I think Palin is a post-turtle. And a Gallup guy asks, what's a post-turtle? And the old-timer says, when you're driving down a country road and you come across a fence post with a turtle balanced on top, that's a post-turtle. You know, she didn't get up there by herself. She doesn't belong up there. She doesn't know what to do while she's up there. And you have to wonder what kind of a dumbo put her up there to begin with.
There you go. Well said, Art. Good joke. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. John in Napa, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show. You know, something that everybody is overlooking is that Bush and Paulson are lame ducks. Why the heck are we buying into this?
I know. Because they still have some shred of credibility, because they're so sincere, because they're pushing so hard, but by and large, Americans aren't buying it. Republicans aren't buying it. And the Democrats are going to get stuck with this again. This is just friggin' nuts. There's no other way to say it. Ken in New Jersey. Hey, Ken. Thanks for the call, by the way. Hey, Ken, what's up?
This is sort of a follow-up on the call about the martial law. In a way, it's sort of already unfolding in slow motion.
Oh, they're bringing the first combat brigade or the third combat brigade back from Iraq right now to start patrolling the United States on October 1st.
Right, I heard that. And on the basis of that, I would submit to you that the meme that 9/11 changed everything up there with Karl Rove is one of the two most serious threats to our democracy at this moment.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Ken. I'm very concerned about this and the anti-constitutional legislation they've been passing. Richard in Detroit, listening on WDTW. Hey, Richard.
How you doing, Tom?
Fine. What's up?
I had two quick things. I just think that this whole thing is such a trap. The Republican president puts this out. The Democrats run and hey, we got to get this done. They pick it up. The Republican congressmen disassociate themselves from it, and the Democrats are calling them back in.
Yep.
Why would the Democrats fall for this? I mean, it's awful, Tom. They really looking weak and
they're
dumb.
Falling for it, Richard, because they're decent people and trusting people, and they find it hard to believe that somebody else would.
But it's been done too. This is about
I know. They should be more cynical. They really should. It's like, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. You know, and as even Bush mangled that one. I mean, the Democrats are just, you know, they actually believe in good government. And which, you know, the good news about that is that they would actually run a good government. The bad news about that is that they're vulnerable to these guys. I remember when I was a little kid, when I was like six years old, I was in kindergarten or first grade. And a kid in my class accused me of stealing his pencil and escalated it to the point where the teacher was like, had the whole class searching for it and had me over in the corner and they were going through my desk and they never found the pencil, right? Mm-hmm. And I went home and I was just in tears that any, you know, this kid would accuse me of this. I mean, cause I hadn't stolen his pencil. And this kid was always accusing people of stealing things. And my dad said to me, don't ever trust that kid. And I said, you know, what do you mean? And he said, people always assume everybody else does what they do. And that kid is probably a thief. He said, you know, the people who are accusing everybody of stealing are the people who will steal if given an opportunity. The people who are accusing everybody of being any particular way are the people who are typically that way. So here we have these Republicans who are, you know, constantly accusing the Democrats of being corrupt and accusing the Democrats of trying to ruin the country and saying, oh, liberals hate America and all that stuff. Why? Because they do, or because that's how they're thinking. I mean, that's the bottom line. But the Democrats, on the other hand, what they're revealing by their behavior is that they actually believe in the positive power of government. They actually believe that the president should have some credibility. They actually believe the truth should be told. And you know, it's their tragic weakness when they're confronted with a liar, but when they have power, it is their greatest strength.
Right.
It just
seems unrational to keep falling for the same old, put you in a,
I know,
you know, the same old trap.
I
know. And just on a real quickly on another issue, I write a lot over at www.blackboysincrisis.com. Mm-hmm. We in the black community have, that's one particular crisis is going on with our boys, Tom. And some leaders believe it's reaching almost genocidal proportions. And while we wholly support and are doing everything that we can to get Barack Obama elected, a lot of us are getting kind of worried because we don't hear any of our issues being discussed, you know, concretely in the campaign, the thing that the Republicans have done with public schooling and attack public schooling and trying to privatize and ruin public schooling in most of the urban communities across the country,
yep.
And nobody's talking about it.
Well, there's good news and bad news with regard to that, Richard. The bad news is that nobody's talking about it right now, and the reason is pretty straightforward. Look at McCain's last four major campaign ads. Each one featured a black guy. I mean, they got Kwame Kilpatrick in an ad against Barack
right.
Obama. I don't think they even know each other.
Right.
I mean, you know, what they're trying to do is say to the white racists out there or just the fearful whites who've never had an African American as a friend and never had a relationship. They're,
right.
You know, look out, it's the boogeyman, you know, that kind of thing. They're playing not just the race card, but a fearful card.
Definitely.
And so because of that, Obama really can't address those kinds of issues in the way that they need to be. But if you look at what he did when he was a community organizer in Chicago, I mean, he was organizing blacks and whites together. He was bringing communities together. He was making things happen. As president, those issues will be addressed. And that's why it's so much more important that we get him elected. I mean, it's really important that we get him elected. And I would just not worry about the fact that those issues aren't being addressed because they're, you know, tragically. But, you know, welcome. This is a racist society. You know it better than I do.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I'm telling you, the closest I got to it.
A lot. Know it, lived it. Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, the closest I got to it was when my next door neighbor, there was a girl my age. And this is when I was like 18 or 19. And she wanted to marry an African-American man. And her father refused to go to the wedding. And my father volunteered to walk her down the aisle. And for the next 15 years that family lived next door to my parents, they never again talked to my family.
Wow.
And I mean, that's how it plays out in this is, you know, just in Lansing, Michigan, just, you know, it's small town. Well, it's not small town. It's medium sized, whatever. But I mean, I guess I've said enough. Richard, and there goes the music.
I enjoy your show. Maybe you should check it out, blackboysincrisis.com.
Okay. I'll do it.
Thank
blackboysincrisis.com. I'll check it out. Thanks a lot, Richard. Good to hear from you. 44 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Hey, thanks so much. Thanks so much. Sean Taylor. By the way, Sean's having her surgery today. She fell down and broke her ankle in a couple of places. So, you know, keep her in your prayers, your thoughts, or send her some light. Louise Hartman, Sue Nethercutt, just the whole bunch. I Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, Michael Toth, everybody. There are so many people who make this program work, and I'm so appreciative of all of them. And you, in particular, for listening. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, I am actually in Oxford, Mississippi, looking over the square. Actually, I'm looking over Haley Barbour's chief of staff right now, who's on the phone. And the town is quite ready for this debate. It's interesting. They are having a McCain watch party at one of the theaters here, and then afterwards there is apparently a party that McCain is going to be at. So the town is really quite ready for this, and in a sense, in a pretty bipartisan way, we actually counted more Obama signs as we came in through the town than we did McCain by a long shot. And of course, it's a university town, so even though it's in the Deep South, much more liberal. There has been, of course, the president today made a statement at the White House about the whole negotiations, and he said, well, it's been hard work. I'm sure you have some of the audio from it. And then Dana Perino said later that this plan was not the president's first choice. She was asked, did he not have any power? Had he lost his power to push this away? And she said, well, the president had everyone here, so he obviously still has power. And again, she repeated that the president's first instinct was not to go down this road.
Well, what was his first instinct?
Well, we don't know what his first instinct was, but it wasn't apparently this one. Then today, Banking Chair Dodd and Harry Reid said that the deal could be reached in the Senate, and that the Senate really wanted it to be bipartisan. But they also said, and actually Chairman Frank said that the administration guys, Bernanke and the head of the Treasury Department, were blindsided by this Republican, that they had not mentioned a word to them before yesterday.
The Republican, now, is this coming from the Republican leadership? Is Boehner and who is it in the Senate who's the Republican leader?
Well, Mitch McConnell.
Mitch McConnell, right. Thank you.
No, it's definitely not coming from McConnell. McConnell's apparently on board with the Democrats to a large degree. Now, what's also interesting is the White House had absolutely said no to a second stimulus bill. But back to the deal, they are saying now that the non-negotiable is the executive compensation, that taxpayers be covered, and they believe that they're going to figure into this. Schumer went off on McCain today and said earlier, before the decision was absolutely made, that he was coming to the debate, and said that Bush should tell McCain to get out of town. And it's interesting. I've been sitting with, there's a sort of one restaurant in town where all the politicos go, and I ran into a lot of Haley Barbour people that a lot of people introduced me to. I have a little whatever in this town because, of course, I know Haley.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said to everybody, and I was trying to sort of get a little reaction, I didn't accept some eyeballs. I said I would have given my last dollar to be in the room when Haley Barbour heard that McCain may not come to this debate.
I can imagine.
Because, and everybody, nobody would say, oh, yeah, you should have been in the room. But I can just tell from their looks that it wasn't a pretty picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Ellen, it appears to me that the political calculus here, it's very Karl Rove, very Newt Gingrich, is to bind the Democrats to George W. Bush and to separate John McCain from George W. Bush, so along with a small number of Republicans who are probably in on this thing. And with regard to this bailout deal, which has very little public support, both all the conservative talk shows,
and then
most
to be able to go after and say, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's very much, I agree with you. I think you put it very succinctly. It is a strategy that could backfire on the Democrats.
I think
however,
it already is.
The Democrats are saying bipartisan, bipartisan, bipartisan. And if they can somehow get that message, then the Karl Rove strategy won't work.
Right.
But, I mean, this whole White House deal yesterday was the Democrats realized, unfortunately, only later that they'd been had.
Yeah, the whole thing was set up to help McCain.
Right.
I mean, it was just that was so obvious to me. You know, when Obama made his speech and day before yesterday and said, you know, I'm not going to go up to Washington, D.C. I don't want to inject, you know, I don't want to inject presidential politics into delegate negotiations. And, you know, he's not on the committees that are doing this. Neither is McCain. There's no reason for them to be there. The committees come up with the first draft of the legislation in all cases. And just stay out of the way and let the people who are experts at this stuff do their job. And so the Rove machine, and there's no doubt in my mind that Karl Rove is behind the scenes with Sarah Palin big time, and with John McCain, but in particular through Palin. The Rove machine and Steve Schmidt said, let's have George order you up here. And so George says, everybody to Washington, and all of a sudden Obama's on a plane.
Good point. One quick thing, James Meredith is not coming to debates, but he is doing an AIDS rally because he wants to force both sides to put more money in AIDS. Apparently his son died of AIDS.
Ooh. Ouch. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's going to be a great evening tonight. Don't forget to check out the debates. I probably don't have to tell you, but, you know, this is going to be fascinating. And don't forget, the democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and get active. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.